This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, October 21st. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. What would this down and dirty political year look like if it were a work of fiction? To get at this question, we need to start off with one of the country's great real-life political anti-heroes. Here's a clip from one of David Frost's interviews with Richard Nixon in May 1977. Frost asked him about his approval of illegal wiretapping, burglaries, and black bag jobs against anti-war groups and the Democratic National Committee, and the subsequent move to impeach him. He replied,
I don't know what was going on in some Republican, some Democratic circles as far as the so-called impeachment lobby was concerned. However, I don't go with the idea that what brought me down was a coup, a conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I brought myself down. I gave them a sword, and they stuck it in, and they twisted it with relish. And I guess if I had been in their position, I'd have done the same thing.
The political novelist Thomas Mallon joins me to discuss how fiction writers approach their protagonists and their demons. Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
You've written 9 novels, I believe, most of them works of historical fiction. This year, way back during the primaries, you and I were talking, and you proposed a piece for the magazine about what the 2016 election might look like in retrospect. The pieces will be out in a couple of days in the New Yorker's politics issue. At the time, it was impossible to imagine how this campaign would unfold, yet your premise really stands. It didn't change much at all. How did you decide on your protagonist and how you would approach this?
Well, once it was clear who the nominees were going to be, I had to decide the biggest question for any kind of novelist, political or otherwise, and that's who's going to carry the point of view? You know, from inside whom are we going to see events? And I quickly rejected Trump as a point of view character because I think a point of view character has to have an active, changeable inner life. And I think Trump's inner life is very constant. I talk in the piece about how he does not meet E.M. Forster's definition of a round character. And a round character is one who can surprise the reader convincingly. I don't think Trump ever surprises us. He may outrage us. He may cause our jaws to drop. But there's no real element of surprise because it all seems to proceed from something that we know. With Mrs. Clinton, I think it's very, very different. I think she's a much more protean, changeable person. She made a joke about how it takes a village to write all these jokes last night when she was addressing the Cardinals dinner up in New York. But you can hear it in her. She has different tones of voice, even different regional accents for groups that she speaks to. Her affect is very changeable, and I think her inner life is much more convulsive than Trump's. I mean, that's one irony about this. I mean, we think of Trump as being such an explosive figure, but I do think he's relatively constant, whereas I think Mrs. Clinton lives with all of this inner churning.
You also write that thoughts of Nixon inevitably bring one to Hillary Clinton. One of the things that interested me in your novel about Nixon, Watergate, which came out, 4 years ago, was that he was not what we expected. He was not so much the kind of paranoid, foul-mouthed loner obsessed with his enemies. He was really a sympathetic character.
My sense was that Nixon had been reduced to this monochromatic figure, this mustache-twirling villain, and I didn't want to write that. For one thing, I didn't believe that was him. And I thought that the best way to do that was to go inside and try to show his mind as it was operating, what he was thinking as he was approaching decisions, blunders, sometimes great achievements even. I think that he has a lot in common with Hillary Clinton. They both have a penchant for secrecy. They both have a penchant for fudging the truth when they don't need to, which is interesting. I mean, I think you can separate those politicians who don't tell the truth because that's an occupational demand from those politicians who sometimes don't tell the truth even when there's no point to fudging it, to fibbing, to outright lying. There's an element of that that the two of them share, just as I think the two of them share the fact that if she wins, indeed, She will come to the presidency, as did Richard Nixon, as somebody who is supremely qualified to be president. They both have experience. Even in 1960, when I was in the fourth grade, I used to go to school every day wearing a Nixon Lodge button. We were not very good Catholics. We were not for Kennedy, and I had absorbed my father's politics. But the slogan was experience counts. That, I think, is interesting, too. Experience has become such a dirty word in politics. But even in 1960, experience was Nixon's strong suit.
Speaking about the 1960s, in the piece you invert the slogan, the personal is political, and you say that to a novelist, the political is personal. Talk a little bit about that and your belief that politics does terrible things to people who practice it.
When I say that the political is personal, I mean there's always a personal dimension and a personal cost to be paid for acting politically. It can be losing friends. It can be making enemies. It can be making enemies on principle. It can be making enemies because of double dealing with enemies. It can be feelings of self-loathing. I think there's a tremendous amount of self-loathing and shame among politicians because in order to do their work, they constantly have to cut moral corners. I mean, this very revealing comment that has been thrown back at Mrs. Clinton in the last week or so about how one has to have a private view and a public view. She's really expressing what is standard operating procedure among politicians, but it costs them. They know the deceptions they practice. They know the corners that they cut. I think many of them have terrible family lives. They spend a lot of their lives away from their families, traveling, grubbing for money. They now live their entire lives in front of people's iPhone cameras. They don't have a private moment except when they are absolutely in their own home behind, you know, locked doors. I think in many ways it's a terrible life. And I think a lot of people who go into it for principled reasons. I think by the time years pass, a lot of them have to kid themselves to think that that's the main reason they're still in it.
Listening to you talk about that, it occurs to me that Barack Obama has somehow seemed to avoid that. He seems remarkably free of self-loathing. His marriage seems a very good one. There has not been a single personal or truly, you know, big political scandal during the course of his two terms. Does he fit into your model?
I think he's somewhat apart from it. The coolness of Obama that is always, you know, remarked upon. I think he's had to find a private space, and by that I mean a space within himself, in a set of circumstances that's very different from anybody else who's ever held the office. On the one hand, I think he has had, by and large, a remarkably compliant press. And you see this, I think, as the final months of the administration go by. There's tremendous nostalgia and sentimental commentary. On the other hand, for obvious reasons, there has never been a president who has had to deal with the visceral undercurrents of racial hatred and resentment that some people have looked upon him with. So I think he has had to have a good deal of character in order to navigate.
You know, we've all been wringing our hands about the coarsening of public discourse, which we've seen ad nauseum in this campaign. In your novels, you've gone all the way back to the Lincoln presidency. Weren't those 19th century campaigns just as scurrilous as this one?
Yes. there were terrible, terrible things that went on, that were said. Yet, I don't think that we should necessarily aspire to that or find ourselves experiencing some nostalgic pull for the gutter campaigns of the previous, two centuries ago now. I do think in terms of the average American's lifetime, let's say, this campaign has been nothing like anything that they remember. I mean, as late as 1958, Harry Truman would throw some real spitballs that the Republicans had stuck a pitchfork in the farmer's back and, you know, comparing the people around Dewey to a kind of fascist council. But I think this dinner that I keep coming back to in my head, this Al Smith dinner last night, was so, so revealing about the state of politics today and the state of this race. The Al Smith dinner is used to gentle humor, most of it self-deprecating. It's, an event that is supposed to evoke Smith's nickname, which was the Happy Warrior. I didn't see two happy warriors up there last night. I saw two people who were, by and large, exhausted, miserable, contemptuous of each other, and to some extent, just covered with dirt.
I can say nothing in response to that, except that I agree.
As Lady Bracknell would say, my opinions on this subject, as indeed upon all subjects, are strong, or something
and
like that.
And that brings us to Irving Howe, whom you also cite in your piece, who wrote that politics rakes our passion as nothing else. So how does the political novelist, first of all, tame some of this passion and then coax the reader into considering the point of view that he normally finds utterly despicable?
I like to think that historical fiction, political fiction, can accomplish something even beyond what well-wrought biography can accomplish, and that is to give a sense of intimacy, humanness, to the main subject of whatever the book happens to be. A good biographer can do quite a bit, but the biographer always has to hedge, always has to use the subjunctive. It's not impossible to think that at this moment Nixon may have thought ... The novelist just goes ahead and has him think it. Now, there's a tremendous ahistorical factor to that, but there's also an intimacy to it. And I do think that you can get at certain emotional truths or approximate them in ways that you cannot always do in nonfiction. If you are seeing that person from the inside out and you are experiencing that person's point of view, you necessarily begin to develop a greater degree of sympathy for the person.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
We have to talk about this week's debate. You and I were speaking just yesterday, I think, and you told me that you found Clinton more dislikable than you ever had. You're not a big fan of hers to begin with. Yet you conceded her skill in demolishing Trump.
Mrs. Clinton, throughout all three debates, was steady. She was focused. She did not let herself get rattled. I think she was on the verge of that the other night. And she has been an A student all her life. And she can master whatever position she is holding. I'm tempted to say at the moment. But she can she can do that. She can articulate it. I can't think of any presidential candidate in my lifetime who has won all of the debates, and I think she won all of them. I'd say that she was up against an unusual opponent, but even people with great rhetorical skills, like President Obama, I mean, who it's generally conceded lost the first debate to Mitt Romney in 2012 and lost it pretty badly, in fact. So I give her full marks for that, but there was no sense of intellectual satisfaction or no sense that the issues were being really aired, because you knew that it was immediately going to have to go back to whatever preposterous thing Donald Trump was saying. One of the things that has been very apparent to me, aside from his personality features, his mind is very flabby. There's no nimbleness to it. He can't take something and rebut it, whereas Hillary's mind is extremely nimble.
You imagine Clinton on election night, and I was a little surprised by how you thought she would be feeling.
I don't think she will be elated. I think that she's going to suffer from the sort of depression that comes upon almost anyone when they've achieved something big. But I think if you go back to 1972 and you listen to Nixon, if you listen to the tapes that were made of his phone conversations on the night of his enormous victory over George McGovern, he sounds depressed. He sounds blue. And I think she is going to feel that because the sense of fraudulence kicks in. I talk about this in the piece, you know, among compulsive achievers, compulsive high achievers, the fraud complex and so forth. But I think that other things are going to bother her. One of the things I think is particularly going to bother her is the idea that Donald Trump was the best thing that ever happened to her. I think that Hillary has believed in, you know, again, the A student doing everything on the merits all of her life. And I think that she will be somewhat haunted by the real possibility that she could never have attained the White House without him as an opponent. I mean, I am among those people who think that a mainstream Republican candidate right now would probably be on his way to the White House.
And you don't think she'll be caught up in the euphoria of being the first female president? You feel that a little bit when you watch her now.
One thing that will shift immediately, if she is elected, the moment she is elected, she becomes infinitely larger an historical figure than Bill Clinton. 200 years from now, school children hear the word Clinton. She will be the person that they think of, not Bill Clinton.
You're a lifelong Republican, and you know, everybody's now wondering where this election leaves the party of Lincoln and your party. What do you think?
Well, I actually, for many years, I was an independent. I tended to vote for Republicans, yes, but I've definitely had Republican leanings and have just signed, you know, this statement of miserable Republicans who could not possibly vote for Donald Trump. The party of Lincoln is in a very parlous place, and I think that there are going to be recriminations to beat the band. There are going to be purges, but it's going to be interesting to see who gets purged. You know, will the party go to somebody like Mike Pence and say, well, he's the natural bridge between the establishment that didn't like Trump and Trump's own followers? I don't want anybody who ran as Donald Trump's vice president to be president of the United States. I'm not going to be in a forgiving mood after this election. I am not going to be able to vote for Trump or Hillary Clinton, and it leaves me angry. I will write somebody in. I don't know who that's going to be yet. A friend of mine the other night said, why don't you write in George H.W. Bush? You admired the first President Bush. So I thought, maybe I'll write in George H.W. Bush. And I took about 10 seconds worth of solace in that before it also dawned on me. And I thought, oh, my God, that means Carter could be back at some point.
Let's go back to that moment we listened to at the beginning of the program when Nixon is talking about giving his enemies a sword. Clinton is just as aware of her enemies, she always has been, as he was of his. What kind of ammunition do you think she will give them in her years in the White House?
I think she is addicted to secrecy. That is going to get her into trouble. She's addicted to secrecy and addicted to control, which Nixon increasingly became addicted to as he was president. I also think she arrives at the office with so many battle scars and so many resentments, and I don't think she has an especially forgiving nature, nor did he. And I think that she will trip herself up by trying to control too many things that are beyond her control. She is not capable, I don't believe, of stepping back and looking at herself with a certain ironic detachment. One of the things that I think was very compelling and probably healthy about Franklin Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan, utterly different in terms of their personalities in general, but one of the things that the three of them had in common was this ability to step back out of themselves, to watch themselves, and to be amused by themselves. I don't think that is impossible. Nixon could never emerge from himself, and I don't think Mrs. Clinton is able to do that either. I think they are condemned 24/7 to live as themselves and not observe themselves.
Oh, on that somber note, we're going to stop, but I want to get you to come back on perhaps the end of the first year of the Clinton administration and have you talk about that.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Thomas Mallon, a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, is the author of Watergate, Henry and Clara, about the Lincoln assassination, and a novel about Ronald Reagan, Finale. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.